Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, happy Labor Day. All right, you guys, you promised. I'm here. It's Labor Day. This is a live program. It is, in fact, the third day of September 2012, the first broadcast day of a new month, and it also happens to be Labor Day. So, welcome aboard. Jump on into the chat room. Crowd is already gathering. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom is how you get there. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is, of course, our home, the easiest way to get the live or rerun stream, depending on your preference. There's a listen live button there. But, you know, there are a number of other platforms, and we're awfully proud to be part of TuneIn Radio. And we're happy to be carried at Stitcher Internet Radio. And we're happy to be at Tuner Internet Radio, as well as a variety of other platforms. Our podcasting home is, of course, WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can also find our podcasts at iTunes. The other thing that you will find at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, as well as the Daily Show posts, is the little widget telling you how we're doing for fundraising so far this month. You will note that it is at $100. And frankly, we've got to get to $2,500 every month if this is going to continue. And because of the way things work, there are always bills to pay. We got some, and frankly, we're in a hole. So let's get a vigorous start, please, on keeping the horn on the air and making sure there's an October. What happens in September, make sure there's an October. What happens in October, make sure there's a November. But we can't even talk about November yet, because we haven't even made certain of October. That's what happens in September. So please, if you can, let's jump out there and take care of it. And remember, I was reminded by our good buddy Scott in Sweden, the Beat the Swede Challenge obtains every month in the year of in the remainder of the year, every month that we exceed the monthly fundraising goal. Our buddy Scott, the progenitor of the Beat the Swede Challenge, will kick in an extra $100 to help us keep things going. There are phone bills. There are internet bills. There are power bills. There are a number of... Well, let's put it this way. The fundraising goal that we have up there is not even the entirety of what it takes to keep everything going. It's just what we need on the listener end of things. And frankly, without it, we're gone. And that's a matter of fact. It's not a joke. It's part of the reason we're doing a Labor Day broadcast when so many others are taking the day off. I don't know. Maybe people aren't taking the day off. Maybe a lot of folks are down in Charlotte getting a little pre-party in. I don't know. It is Labor Day, and therefore I think it would be untoward to mark this down as a sort of Moran Monday. But there will be some things that would easily fall into that category. A couple of remarks on Labor Day, though.
Are you a woman who sometimes finds it difficult to afford expensive
clothes? No, not yet. Not yet. I didn't mean to play that yet. Dadgummit. We'll get there. I promise. We really, really will. A couple of remarks on Labor Day. Labor Day came into being, you probably know, because you actually give a damn about working people as opposed to, you know, say, the Republican Party. But Igor Volsky over at Think Progress pointing out that Eric Leave Britney Alone Cantor, you remember why we call him that, right? He couldn't be present for an important House session because he was having a fundraiser at a Britney Spears concert at the Verizon Center in D.C. No, really. Leave Britney alone! Yeah. Eric Cantor tweeted today, quote, "Today we celebrate those who have taken a risk, worked hard, built a business, and earned their own success." Bullshit. See, we can say that because we're on the Internet and we don't have any nasty little FCC censors riding our butts. Hi, Agent Fred. How you doing? Yeah. Hope you got some barbecue today. Yeah. Hi, NSA. Hi. But still, no, really, we can say that. We can say that Eric Cantor is as full of shit as a Christmas goose because he is and because we are uncensored. Labor Day is not a day to celebrate those who've taken a risk, worked hard, built a business, and earned their own success. No, hell no. This is a day for honoring working stiffs. Well, I hope that a little mosquito in the studio. I hope you ain't no West Nile mosquito. Dang it. Probably don't have the money to spray here either. Teaspoon of pyrethrin in a damn barrel of water. No, this is a day to celebrate, and not just celebrate, but remember the sacrifices of working stiffs, of people who labor for pay by the hour, sometimes by the day. It has turned into a ritual of the end of summer. My God, it seems to have gotten here in a hurry this year. I guess being a political year, I should not be surprised. I had a note from Ron in Raleigh before the program. He said, well, it's Labor Day, the symbolic end to summer. It used to be a celebration of workers and labor unions, but not anymore. Workers have become a target of disdain and derision. How is it that the people have been the foundation of the middle class and yet have become those that are pointed out as the blame for the condition our economy's in? I look around and all I see is those who should be punished for wrongdoing. They're let off without so much as a slap on the wrist. Goldman Sachs, no prosecutions by the DOJ. The CIA, no prosecutions for torture. It's not just in the U.S. In Israel, the soldier that ran over a defenseless 23-year-old woman, Rachel Corrie, with what has become a weapon of mass destruction, a Caterpillar D9, the same thing, I might add, that they use up on mountaintop removal sites. How about that? Gets off because the judge says it was in a war zone and she brought it on herself. Well, you know, right. She brought it on herself, just like the folks in the ghetto uprising in Warsaw brought it on themselves, right? My frustration, says Ron, has turned to anger because I don't see anything swinging toward justice or what's right. I'd hoped when I voted for Barack Obama that for once I was not voting for the lesser of two evils, but now at the end of his first term, all the soaring rhetoric of hope and change has turned to bitter ash. I'm not saying that some good things haven't happened, but what I am saying is that most of those things are half measures, narrowly focused to help only a few. The time frame of the help stretched over too long a period. I personally am at the end of my ability to draw unemployment compensation, and despite the fact that I diligently apply for all the jobs I'm well qualified to do, the gatekeepers in HR won't consider me for a position because I'm, in their opinion, too old to be offered a job. If you're unemployed, I recently read, you are much less likely to be offered a job than someone that is currently employed. Employment has become a closed system. Willard Romney, that's Bishop Willard Romney, Ron, says in his first term he will create 12 million new jobs, yet no one ever asks him, doing what? I don't have much time left on this earth, says Ron, and I don't think anything will be moving in a positive direction while I'm still alive. I worry for my nieces and nephews and other young people, because life is going to be much harder in the Ayn Rand objectivist libertarian dog-eat-dog world that 1% want to leave for them. Maybe sometime in the not-too-distant future, people will reclaim their rights and toss the moneylenders out of the political temple and put the true meaning of Labor Day back in the hearts and minds of the American people. Maybe. Maybe, Ron. I hope you're right. I do. Didn't feel like much of a day for celebration here. No health care. No retirement. Social Security under attack. No hope of collecting Medicare when I turn 65. But work we do, day in and day out. No, this is not 15 miles on the Erie Canal getting behind this microphone every night, but it is labor. It is work. And frankly, the odds of me finding something else to do in West Virginia, forget about it. Labor Day. Labor Day that a millionaire thug in a gray suit in D.C. tried to turn into a celebration of some sort of Ayn Randian-esque pornography. Eric Cantor. Utterly forgetting what happened in 1894, the year my grandmother was born. Just a few months later. Pullman, Illinois. A company town. Founded by George Pullman, president of the Railroad Sleeping Car Company. His Pullman, Illinois, was supposed to be, in the words of this article at PBS NewsHour, a utopian town, a utopian workers' community insulated from the moral and political seductions of nearby Chicago. The article goes on, the town was strictly, almost feudally organized. Row houses for the assembly and craft workers, modest Victorians for the managers, and a luxurious hotel where Pullman himself lived and where visiting customers, suppliers, and salesmen would lodge while in town. The article continues to note that an economic panic struck the United States in 1893, and business fell off dramatically. George Pullman laid off hundreds of employees. The ones who were kept had their wages slashed. But George Pullman never reduced the rents in his properties, commensurate with the wages of which he had deprived his workers. One hopes. You know, this is another one of those I wish I could believe in hell moments, because you'd like to just... Daddy! Yeah, I got Mr. Pullman rebasted again. It's time to eat all the flesh off of his bones and then let it all grow back and start barbecuing him again over and over again for all eternity. Come and get it! Led to a strike. Led by a young man who would go on to become an American hero. A young man named Eugene V. Debs of the American Railway Union. And a nationwide boycott was on of any train that carried a Pullman car. There were riots. And eventually, President Grover Cleveland declared that workers withholding their labor were committing a crime against the United States of America and deployed 12,000 members of the military to break the strike. U.S. Marshals gunned down a pair of men in Kensington near Chicago, and the strike was crushed. They put Eugene Debs in prison. The American Railway Union was obliterated, and Pullman employees were forced to pledge that they would forevermore remain unrepresented and uncollectivized and never try to have any sort of joint voice among their other workers, that they would, in fact, never again organize a union. And that is what brought on Labor Day. Labor Day was born in blood. All labor has some aspect of blood to it. And in 1894, President Cleveland faced a re-election. He was the incumbent. And he signed off on a bill to create Labor Day as a national holiday, and he lost the election just the same, because working people perhaps remembered how he had sent in the troops to crush their hopes, crush their dreams, and crush their modest requests for some semblance of human dignity. Samuel Gomper said in 1898 that Labor Day was the day for which the toilers in past centuries looked forward, when their rights and their wrongs would be discussed. That the workers of our day may not only lay down their tools of labor for a holiday, but upon which they may touch shoulders in marching phalanx and feel the stronger for it. And then, but just the same, today we have Eric Cantor saying, today we celebrate those who have taken a risk, worked hard, built a business, and earned their own success. That really brings out the urge toward obscenities in me. I don't do it. Not going to do it. Pissant. Close as I'm going to get. Go to hell, Eric Cantor, and get in a hurry doing it. Dr. John writing in with a response to Ron and Raleigh's note. He says, paraphrasing Ron's question, why don't the people who built and supported the middle class get any breaks or respect? Dr. John says, because it's constantly reinforced by the schools, the churches, and the media that what's good for the 1% is good for everybody. If you're hurting, you should get rich or shut up and help the 1% get their tax cuts. It'll benefit you, prole! At the risk of tipping my hand, Dr. John says, Marx and Gramsci had a word for that. They called it ideology. David in South Carolina noting, and here is the big war, Willard in France during Vietnam War hero, SEAL Team 6 has apparently thrown its support behind, if this is true. If it is true that SEAL Team 6 has thrown its support behind Bishop Willard Romney, then F you, SEAL Team 6, says David in South Carolina. You should serve the Commander-in-Chief and Constitution as you took an oath to do and not be out politicking. For Bishop Willard, war hero, you are a disgrace to the Navy, the U.S. Armed Forces, the U.S. Constitution, and the USA, and I will, says David in South Carolina, never salute you. It's Labor Day. It's Labor Day. You know, with the Pullman strike in 1894, it only got worse. Every time labor reared its head, the 1% were there to cave in its skull. Colorado, Montana, Indiana, West Virginia. The entirety of the first two decades of the 20th century were the area where I live was a war zone. At one point, with an armored car on a railroad train going down a holler with machine guns shooting up the homes of workers in what was it was called the Bull Moose Special. And that wasn't even the U.S. military. It was just legal for the 1% to hire guns to blow away working people. Can you shoot a peasant? Well, let me see. Doesn't say you can't. No, I think we can shoot a peasant. Fire when ready. But Dr. John's right. In the schools and, Lord knows, in the churches, they teach that submission to the will of wealth is the way we get to heaven. Of course, Joe Hill, who was murdered by the state, by the way, on trumped-up charges, he was a labor rabble-rouser, a songwriter, once said of the religion industry, "Live on hay, day by day, there'll be pie in the sky when you die." It's Labor Day. Clayton asking, can we remember the Chug of Chicago riots? Can we remember Big Bill Haywood? Can we remember those two anarchists that were killed in Pennsylvania and so many more? Sacco and Vanzetti? The degree, Clayton reminds us, to which you resist is the degree to which you are free. David writes from Orlando. David in Florida. Yeah, David's all over the place. Happy Labor Day. Thanks for working. David continues, I told you I'd be listening, and here I am. Thank you so much for your show. I really enjoy it. Thank you. Thank you, David, for the time that you take to share in the conversation. It's Labor Day. Do you have a labor history in your family? Even if you, like me, are not a member of a labor union, even if you, like me, have no union that has no interest whatsoever in you, do you have a labor union in your history, in your family? Because if you do, chances are it's why you're here. Because otherwise, the peasantry, the proles, and let's get real realistic here on this Labor Day evening. It's what we are. We're never going to be Carnegies or Rockefellers, like that hateful twit in Australia said, you know, we like our drinking and smoking too much. So we'll never be rich like her. Of course, it helped her a hell of a lot to have her wealth left to her. Freaking yard cow. But if you have somewhere in your past a labor union, odds are it has contributed significantly to the fact that you are on this planet right now. It might contribute to your very existence. Or it might contribute to your education. You might be a member now, and if you are, you have my respect and my admiration. It's Labor Day. We have seen a report in the last couple of weeks that shows that the decline in wages is directly attributable to the decline in union membership in this country. Huh, how about that? I don't think that's a coincidence. I think the relentless assault on working people's rights to organize, freedom of association, we call it, it's supposed to be enshrined in the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. However, that First Amendment has been reduced to little more than a life support system for the religion industry. Where was I going? Oh, well. No, I have labor organizations in my background. Primarily the United Mine Workers of America. My son is the grandson on both sides of United Mine Workers coal miners. I'm the son, grandson, and great-grandson of United Mine Workers coal miners. And, of course, the pressure is relentlessly upon them right now, Patriot Coal, which is one of the largest, if not the... No, it's the largest mountaintop removal operation in West Virginia, Hobet, is in the business and in the process of trying to screw its workers, be they union or non-union. And in the process of screwing their workers, they seek most eagerly to screw their retirees, you know, those useless eaters who aren't doing anything for the company now, who gave up a significant portion of their wages in the present so that they might have it in their old age and thus have as well some measure of dignity. And the UMWA has a campaign going on in southern West Virginia now. You might want to sit down for this one. The UMWA is passing out signs, damned ironic to note this on Labor Day, that say, Fairness for Patriot. Fairness for Patriot. Not fairness for Patriot workers. No, these United Mine Workers of America signs don't say that. They say fairness for Patriot. They don't say fairness for Patriot retirees. No, these signs put out by the United Mine Workers of America say fairness for Patriot. Fairness for the 1%. When it's Patriot that's trying to screw its workers in the first place. Whether you do it with the pen of a bankruptcy judge or you do it with a gun, quite often the outcome is the same. Grim, miserable, ignominious death. Dr. John says, let's remember the Ludlow Massacre, when Rockefeller turned his guns, the Colorado National Guard, loaned by the governor, onto a tent camp of 1,200 striking coal miners. They killed about 24, including 2 women and 11 children. Before it was over, scores were dead on both sides. Out of it, we get child labor laws and 8-hour work days, but also the enshrining of company unions. We can honor sacrifice, but deplore outcomes, I guess. I guess, Dr. John, I guess. So it's Labor Day. Have you come home from work today? Did you have the day off? Some people did, and I'm glad that they did. Some people would like to have had an opportunity to go to work today, but can't. Here in America, with our new normal. Sandra coined that phrase, the new normal of unconscionable unemployment. The new normal of unemployment benefits that run out. The new normal of Republicans who will hold some of the most fragile families in the country hostage over their desire to be allowed to cut other fragile families' benefits and extend tax cuts for people who don't need them. It's Labor Day. It's Labor Day. Did y'all, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be such a damn downer. There's other things on my mind that have me bothered as well. As we speak, somewhere in Charlotte, North Carolina, a party is going on. I guess there's a lot of parties going on in Charlotte. This particular party has me particularly bothered because I received emails about it. Mm-hmm. Sure did. Let me read it to you. Ah, here it is. Happy Labor Day from AV at the DNC. Dear Bob, happy Labor Day. Appalachian Voices is in uptown Charlotte today, joining thousands of others to experience the 2012 Democratic National Convention, and what a scene it is! Instead of avoiding the crowd this Labor Day, we're part of it! The convention festivities kicked off with Carolina Fest, a street party with food, fun, and fanfare, featuring entertainers James Taylor, Janelle Monae, Jeff Bridges, and others. There are health groups, education groups, faith groups, youth groups, and more. Starting the moment we arrived, decked out in I Heart Mountains buttons, we've spoken to folks from across the country, all here to participate in our democracy as the nation... Our democracy, please. As the nation approaches a monumental election, we ask a simple question. Do you love mountains? Invariably, people stop, and whether they're from Charlotte, California, or anywhere in between, they say, yes! So now there are scores of festival-goers sporting I Heart Mountains buttons, brochures in hand that will take our message home. We're proud to be here, growing the movement to end mountaintop removal coal mining and transition Appalachia to a cleaner energy future, and it's just beginning. We're looking forward to our reception this evening. Bourbon, bluegrass, and a better future for America, Appalachia. Co-hosted with Greenpeace. The evening will feature numerous special guests, including green jobs guru Van Jones and Representative John Yarmuth of Kentucky, a champion of the Clean Water Protection Act. Now, I don't want anybody to say that I haven't read the whole thing. And tomorrow through Thursday, we'll be looking for every opportunity to talk with members of Congress, convention delegates, and other leaders to convey our important message. End mountaintop removal now, defend the Clean Water Act, and protect Appalachia's environment and communities. Be sure to follow the action at... For the Future, signed, Willa. Now, I just read that in toto. I don't intend to read it again. Did you hear mention of H.R. 5959, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, anywhere in that email? Because it's not there. Because they're not going to mention it. Because it doesn't exist to them. Because they can't fundraise on it. Gloves are off. This organization's called Appalachian Voices. I'm an Appalachian and I got a voice and I'm using it right now and I'm calling them out. If you're not pushing hand over fist, hammer and tongs for the passage of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, then you're not trying to end mountaintop removal. You're just not. Because there is only one bill in the Congress, one bill, not two, not three, one bill in the Congress that would bring mountaintop removal to an end. And that's the AIC Act, H.R. 5959. You know it because you're part of the process that has been, you're the reason that we have the co-sponsors that we have. but there's not a single goddamn mention of it in this blast email. And there won't be. They've got a hashtag, AVDNC, on Twitter, and I put some tweets out there today. If you follow me on Twitter, you know that. Because this kind of crap makes my blood boil. Appalachian Voices is headquartered in Boone, North Carolina. I love the state of North Carolina. It's a beautiful place, and it's blessed not to have any goddamn coal under it. But somewhere, right now, in Charlotte, North Carolina, bourbon is tinkling around ice cubes in glasses. And somewhere today, in some mountaintop removal communities in Appalachia, 11 people died! Because, you see, the number is around 4,000. 4,000 excess deaths in Appalachian mountaintop removal communities every year. So I'm hoping while they're toasting with their bourbon and listening to their bluegrass music, that they'll take a moment to remember that somewhere in a mountaintop removal community, 11 times today, somebody said goodbye to Granny. Somebody wept over an infant. The classmates of a child in a new school year shocked to find that one desk seat would be empty for the rest of the year. God. I'm not okay with this. I talk about this issue because this issue affects me and mine. And when you live in Appalachia, which should be something approaching a life in paradise, these lush green mountains, this temperate rainforest where even the rain is beautiful. The whole damned area is going to be a Superfund site, an entire Superfund region in another few years, if it isn't already, if we don't stop this insanity, this homicidal madness. God damn, do I have any bourbon here? Hell no. At least I got some bluegrass. Yeah, I got some bluegrass. If I'm just being an ass, y'all can tell me. And we'll still be friends. Because friends do that for friends. But if you're not working to end mountaintop removal, if you've got a bill that would end mountaintop removal and it's not the first thing out of your mouth every chance you get to talk about it, then you're not working to end mountaintop removal. And if you're not working to end mountaintop removal, you don't give a good goddamn whether me, my family, my friends, or my neighbors, or my community lives or dies. Apathy is toxic. Insincerity is poisonous. Duplicity is terminal. Yeah, again, I apologize. But also again, am what I am. And if you tune into this program thinking you're going to get some sort of an act or some sort of shtick, sorry. It ain't going to happen. This is my reality. This is the reality of my family and my friends. It really is a lot like having a cocked gun against your head. And every trip to the doctor is a terrifying trip. Because no age group is safe in Appalachia. Because mountaintop removal unleashes so many different poisons that you never know which one's going to get you or what part of your body it's going to affect. We didn't understand why our son was born with a breathing defect. We didn't really even understand why our daughters were having to have their gallbladders out as teenagers. We didn't understand why another daughter has a poisoned thyroid. When none of that runs in our family. None of it. But the science came out. The science came out. And we began to understand. We began to understand. So if you're not going to push the one bill that would end mountaintop removal in this country, and by this country, I mean this countryside, this region, then don't be saying you have an Appalachian voice. Because whatever voice you have, damn sure don't speak for me. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Damn it, I know I got some bourbon here somewhere. I got some bluegrass now.
Them lonesome songs I can tell by the way I feel that it comes from somewhere else. Got that sweet mountain soul down in my bones. I got that sweet in my veins, and it blows through my heart like the mountain rain. And no matter where I might go, these hills and hollows are my home. I got that sweet mountain spirit down in my veins. People call me hillbilly. Some people call me mountain man. You can call me Appalachian. Appalachia's what I am. Me.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182. 82.
Picker's picker, a picker among pickers. Great North Carolina picker. Doc Watson, gone this year. Walk On Boy. Before that, Del McCurry Band. Sweet Appalachia. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. We call what we do here Conversation Radio. And it only works when you're involved. Let me check something here. Kind of unusual not to have this going on by now. Yeah, it works. Phones are open. You know the number, 304-658-3333. Toll free, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. Either way, comes into the same place. Let me do one more thing here. I keep forgetting to do this because it doesn't just stay right on top of my mind. That, and it can get a little bit, well. Quality can be a little dodgy from time to time. But no, we're also available to you on Skype. The handle here, Bob Kincaid, Horn, BobKincaidHorn, if you want to get involved. In the conversation via Skype, that's possible too. And you are welcome to join in. In fact, not a lot of point in being here on Labor Day if we're not going to just talk about what it means. Or, for that matter, I mean, I don't know. Is this just my white privilege shining through that I object to somebody else supposing to speak for me when they can't even mention the one piece of legislation that Appalachian people got introduced in Congress and others have worked so tirelessly to get co-sponsored that they can't even mention it in an email? Is that just my white privilege? Because frankly, it feels the exact opposite. It feels kind of a little bit oppressive. Just saying. But no, the lines are open and the conversation begins now, I hope. Jump on in. Hey, welcome to the program.
It's here from Fort Worth again.
Well, hey. Hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm pretty good. I've been...
Oh, no. This is Sergi. This is Sergi. I'm sorry. You said Fort Worth. I was thinking Edward in Dallas.
No. This is from Fort Worth. Reading literature on about the day-to-day, just to kind of... brush over and see the day for more than just the end of summer, because you know I was brought up. I didn't even know what the meaning of the day was until a couple of years ago when I.
Okay, hey, Sergi, stand by a minute, would you? Stand by. For some reason or another, we've got a real cruddy connection. I'll keep the lines free here, so I'll know that it's you. Could we maybe disconnect and you reconnect, and I'll get you right back on.
All right.
Okay, stand by. We'll disconnect, and I'll get you right back on. Because, you know, when you take the time to call into a program, it's my fondest and sincere hope that you'll actually be heard in what you have to say. Call me crazy. I guess I'm just spoiled that way. But let's see. Take a second here and hopefully get Sergi back on the line. In the meantime, we'll try another one. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob?
Yes.
Hey, new caller here. My tag is just old Granny T from Tennessee.
Oh, Granny T, I know all about you because I hear you on Malloy.
Oh, did ya?
Oh, sure thing.
Well, I was just going to introduce myself to you as I learned about you through Malloy. Well, all right then.
Well, I'm thrilled and honored to hear from you.
Well, I'm thrilled and honored to speak with you, and I tell you, buddy, you yourself are, and you have some very intelligent, well-read, right up there listeners and callers.
Well, I feel like I'm very much privileged here because I get to hear from a lot of people who are a whole bunch smarter than I am, and I get an education every night.
Well, I do too, and I have started listening just right after old Mikey, and I love old Mikey because he can cuss real good.
Oh, he can do what needs to be done. Of course, I've been listening to Mike. I go back listening to Mike to long about 1987, 1988 when he was in Atlanta, and I'd listen to him on the way home from work.
Yeah, well, the reason that I called you. Now, you are a young man if you are 49 years old. I'm 65 and looking right in the eyeballs of 66. And the reason I am calling you is, you know, Make My Day, Clint Eastwood's performance.
Uh-huh.
are the only commentator, the only other person I have heard who came up with not even the chair. My God, after he said that, that song went through my head. So I feel so honored that you mentioned that the other night. I don't know what night it was, but man, I felt so honored. I said, okay, I'm not totally gone yet. If old Bob Kincaid noticed that too.
Well, like I said, Granny T, I started wondering about that line from that song, going back to when I was just a little bitty liberal.
Well, that song came out.
I
say I've got some years on you, and I don't know if you recall Dave Barry. He used to write a hilarious column for Miami Herald.
That's true.
So you remember old Dave Barry, right?
Yes.
And his books are outrageous. And he had a list of the dumbest songs ever written.
Was that on it?
One of them, his number one was MacArthur Park.
Oh, you mean with the cake left out in the rain?
Yeah.
And I'll never have that recipe again?
Yeah.
I've never found the recipe for cake left in the rain yet, but, you know.
Well, I hadn't either, but that is the number one reason I called to just thank God for Bob. No, a goddess, a solitary goddess.
That's all right.
Or spirit being, or
critters.
Planet glob, or golob, or
yeah.
Loco, or whatever it is.
Flying spaghetti monster. They all work.
Yeah. Well, you know, we got to have our little myths, you know.
We sure do.
Anyway, I am so pleased that you did hear me on Malloy, and... Yes, I am so pleased that I got identified with you on Not Even the Chair. I laugh, man. But listen, I won't keep you, Bob. I will let you go, and I might ring you up another day because I sure do enjoy your callers, and I learn many new things. I've tried to read every book in the world, you know, but haven't quite made it, and I learned so much from you and your listeners.
Well, I tell you what, that'll tickle everybody who's ever called in the program.
Well,
It sure will.
I just appreciate them, appreciate you, and appreciate what you're doing, and as far as unions go, we grew up just old poor farmers. I'm third of 11 kids, grew up on a 100-acre farm here in West Tennessee, and spent a lot of years in Texas.
I don't want you to give away your undisclosed location, Granny T.
because it's some pretty outrageous folk around here.
I know for a fact, but I do want you to know that I am familiar with some portions of West Tennessee.
I spent
a summer not too awful far from Jackson many years ago, and
We won't mention that. We'll just say I'm about 40 miles as the crow flies from Nutbush, Tennessee. If you are a Tina Turner fan, you know all about Nutbush, Tennessee.
Indeed. Well, Granny T, you have yourself a wonderful evening. Thank you so much for making this first-time call, and I hope you will call back.
Well, I certainly will. But back to the unions. My first husband's daddy, and he was an old man. You can imagine, since I am 65 myself, he was a teamster, and they were pretty damn rough, and they had some rough stuff to fight against. So... Labor Day, I'm with them. And Eric Foner, if you've ever read any F-O-N-E-R, he's a labor historian, just a super guy. Okay, over and out there, Bob, and all you Bob fans, I'm with you.
All right, you take care now.
You too, Bob.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Oh, that just tickles me. Oh, Granny T calling from Tennessee. And onward. Okay, that's strange. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how are you? It's Mark, your buddy.
Hey, Mark, what's happening, man?
I Hey, did you catch Bill Maher on HBO, Friday?
I don't have HBO, so, but I caught a clip.
I don't have it either, and probably never will, but when I'm on the road, which is always, I get lucky and find a place that usually the quality ends have them. But any case, the ridiculousness of the right winger not believing in science. But he also talks about your subject of the environment. And I'm noticing how environment's popping up in places where it hasn't in the past. It's getting into the dialogue. And so I know you're a part of that, and so am I. I talk to my friends when I can and explain what we're all a part of. And even Mitt Romney's closing comment about Obama wanting to slow down the rise of the tides of the ocean. And
yeah, wasn't that just funny? He must think he's God or something.
I don't know where Utah gets their power. Where they get it from? Probably in California.
No, they blow the hell out of their own mountains to get coal. Remember, it was Bob Murray's Crandall Canyon mine that collapsed a few years back and killed 9 miners.
Uh huh.
And Bob Murray is the same guy that owns the coal mine where the guys weren't even allowed to go to the bathhouse after their shift, but had to stand all dirty behind Willard Romney, you know, the bishop. At his little shindig in southeast Ohio not too long back.
Oh, the forced coal miners that had to attend the rally and not get paid.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm down here in Miami working, Bob, and I guess about 8 years ago, when under the Bush administration they cut open the gates on all the dangerous coal mining, and we saw a lot of Americans getting killed in the coal mines and I said to my friend John, who's been in the union well over 30 years, and I said, well, John, you know, none of those guys are union coal miners. Just take a look. You know, and they even brought them up at our safety meetings, the deaths and the catastrophes, because, you know, we're all a reflection of the same, similar workforce, not the same workforce, but, you know, under OSHA and EPA, and I work in an environment that's supposed to have OSHA oversight and EPA, and thank goodness that I do. I am grateful for that. Thanks to the courage of people from all over the country. I just wanted to say to a lot of the listeners tonight, the Southern Americans are so important. The progressive Southerners are saving this country, and I thank you. I grew up with union handed to me, and you guys have fought for it, and I thank you. I thank Jimmy Carter, and I thank your father, Bob. I thank your humanity for all your callers.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you very kindly. I know it's sincerely offered, and it is accepted with humility.
I can't even talk about it.
I understand.
You guys are so powerful and so sweet, and you've taught this old Yankee so much, and I'm grateful to live in your presence. I got to go.
All right. You take care, Mark. Bye now. It's our buddy Mark. I don't know how to respond, except to say that it's a struggle that we're all in. And I'm deeply disturbed, for instance, when I see the continuing push for this one book that is demanding that the South secede from the United States. And I keep thinking, dear God, what does he want? Does he even know what he's asking for? Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Edward.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got the right one this time.
Yeah. I must have a generic Texas twang.
Well, no, it's not so much that. I heard Fort Worth and I transposed Dallas, and that's shame on me.
Oh, well, we sort of sound alike. Anyway, I'll tell the lady who's 65, she is nothing but a spring chicken.
Yeah.
She's not my age, let me tell you. And Mark, the last guy called, keep up the good work, fella. Don't, as I can't do it in Latin because you know Latin, but it's the Latin phrase. I think it's like non illegitimi carborundum, which translates don't let the bastards get you down.
Don't let the bastards get you down, exactly.
Mm hmm. Oh, me. Well, I listened to Mar this last Friday night, my partner and I did, and we recorded it. And I haven't watched it since, and I will look at it again so I can tell you exactly what happened. He was interviewing this, what's his name, the deceased, is it D'Souza or whatever?
Oh, Dinesh.
Yeah, D'Souza, the guy from India. Anyway.
Yeah, he's the guy behind this goofy 2016 Obama's America movie.
Yeah, that him. Anyway, he made this statement, and I can't remember what it was, but I'll look it up and I'll send it to you. Bill Maher looked at him and said, how far up your ass did you have to go to drag that out?
Good. Somebody needs to be a little bit rude to that guy.
I laughed the heart of fell off the couch. I guess I have a dirty mind or something.
No, I think you were I prefer to thank Edward that you were just reveling in the justice of it.
I was. Sometimes I don't agree with Bill Maher, but boy did I agree with him then. Well, I'll let you go. I know the other people are waiting, and have a very happy day.
Thank you, Edward. Thank you. And you as well. Wonderful.
We're glad to have you on the air so we can call and talk dirty.
Yeah. Maybe we'll just have an all-talk dirty evening one night.
Hey, that would be fun. Take care.
All right. We'll see you, Edward. Bye now.
Bye.
Our buddy Edward calling from Dallas. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Okay, this is Sergi again. I'm hoping my connection's a little better this time.
It's working much better.
Yes, I'm calling from my home phone. I've usually called through my Gmail, but my internet connection's acting up. But basically, I wanted to talk a little bit about the voter ID laws that have been in the news, about the court decisions.
Do please.
Now, you know, I've been on, like, I've surfed progressive websites every day. Huffington Post, Think Progress, etc. And it seems that most of the focus has been on the voter ID laws in what's currently the swing states. The recent strike down of the Texas and South Carolina voter ID laws have gotten a little less coverage. And I feel that is that's not very wise because
inadvisable? Not smart.
Yes, it's not smart, and I'll get to that in a moment. But, you know, first, you know, about the whole ethics of that voter ID thing, I personally can attest to how, you know, how much of a hassle it can be to get that ID and those documents that the Republicans are trying to make a requirement to vote. Like, it is, you know, I'm a minority inner-city resident myself. And at least here in Fort Worth, in order to get a photo ID, you know, you need to have your birth certificate. You got to get your Social Security card. I think I've had to take another form of ID, so thankfully I had my Selective Service card lying around. And the office at which you have to get an ID here is not in the city. You have to, like, I had to ride a bus almost an hour into the suburbs because that's the only office in this part of the county. And then I had to go back a couple more times because of paperwork errors, and it can be a hassle for people who don't drive or, you know, who don't, you know, who have to work, they don't have time, so, you know, it is a general and financial burden on lower-income urban residents who do tend to vote Democratic. You know, I can personally attest to that. You know, it's nothing more than a naked attempt by the Republicans to suppress our vote. However, when it comes to Texas, I predict at least by 2020, probably by 2015, but Texas does have the potential to become a swing state in these next couple of cycles, because Fort Worth is pretty much the only conservative big city left in Texas. Dallas County is blue. Harris County, Travis County, they're all blue now. Texas is, you know, even...
How many, Sergi, how many people even know that? I mean, frankly, I didn't.
I mean, yes, like, if anyone, you know, like anyone who's, you know, hearing this call, you know, I encourage them to go and look at a map, a county-by-county election map from 08, and then compare it to 04, 2096. And now, and like the Dallas County actually went almost 60% Democratic in the last election. And the demographics are only becoming more and more progressive. And that goes for all the big cities in Texas. Fort Worth, even though it's still, or Tarrant County is still a Republican county, it's slowly turning more and more purple. And as the demographics here in Texas change, we're already a majority-minority state. The demographics are going to keep changing, and before long, you're going to start seeing presidential candidates coming down to Texas to campaign, because it will be a swing state. And that's why, you know, defeating voter ID laws in red states is also important, because the demographics are changing.
Absolutely. And let's remember that even if our side doesn't necessarily recognize that, Sergi, the other side damned well did, and that's why those laws are in place. I mean, you don't need to suppress the vote right now. In a place like Alabamistan, I mean, they're going to, come on, Barack Obama doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell in Alabama, or Georgia, or Mississippi. He should, but he doesn't because of the way the districts are, and because of the way that the election process is rigged. So, that voter suppression is not for now. And that's a very astute observation on your point, or on your part. That voter suppression is for later.
Yes, I've been into politics and so forth, and I've noticed the change in demographics, and it's, you know, Texas is going to be a swing state by the 2020s. That I'm almost 100% sure of, because even here in Fort Worth, it's still a majority Republican county, but it's getting narrower and narrower.
Well, you know, I think there's also a larger question, Sergi, and that is this. You say Texas will be a swing state by the 2020s. Will there even be a Republican Party by 2020?
That's a very,
I mean, what I think we see some of in these in things like the attempt to tear down Social Security and destroy Medicare and any other thing that actually is good for working people. What we see here is the violent death throes of a rabid elephant in the midst of a my metaphor is failing me, but yeah, I think you get the idea. They're trying to destroy everything in their sight before, you know, those people can participate.
And also in the, you know, the last, you know, the reason these voter, you know, another reason probably why they're trying to pass these voter ID laws is because they know that their ability to win on issues and principles is dwindling and dwindling. So their next step is just to try and suppress the demographics most likely to vote against them. Because in a few years, that's going to be the only way they're going to remain electorally viable, unless, as I mentioned, you know, in the last time I called the show, unless they start gravitating back towards the center. Their ability to actually win on principle is shrinking because people are repulsed by their policies.
As they should, as anybody with a half a brain and a functioning heart should be.
And, you know, it's this, you know, like, even here, like, you know, I'm very politically active around Fort Worth, and I've noticed, I've seen plenty, it seems that the Republicans here in Tarrant County, and Dallas County for that matter, just aren't even that excited about their own candidate this year. I have seen all kinds of progressive signs in people's yards, Obama stickers on their cars, but then I talked to Romney supporters, and they're like, it's not Obama. Like,
they're not voting. And this has, you know, this dogged us a little bit as progressive people in 2004. they're not voting for someone, they're voting against someone. And when you're voting against someone, it is much more difficult to get someone excited. You really need to feel like you're doing something good in going to the ballot box. That's why this goes hand in hand with voter suppression, to the extent that there is a present value to it in certain swing states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and so forth. Because when you get, do you honestly think, Sergi, that, and I'm not challenging you or anything, but do you honestly think that there's the attendance, the members of the First Gospel Baptist Tabernacle Mega Church and Herpetological Museum are excited about going and voting for a Mormon bishop?
No, they aren't, but they are excited about voting against, you know, Barack.
That's what they've got. You know, they're going to get that Muslim Kenyan out of our White House.
Muslim, I can't get enough of that. But, yes, they're barely anybody's excited about Romney. They're just voting against Obama, you know.
But that's not nearly the motivator that voting for a candidate is. I mean, they were excited to vote for George W. Bush, because he was going to bring in compassionate conservatism and the grown-ups were going to be in charge. Nobody's going to get blowjobs in the White House anymore, remember?
Hey, I don't know. I think they forgot about that compassionate thing the moment they got into office.
Well, that was just a lie.
But basically my overall point is, you know, it's important to pay attention to voter ID laws, you know, all across the nation, because states have the potential to become red states. Are going to become swing states. So it's important to keep these laws off the books to protect the future. You know, we have to think into the future. And that's basically, you know, the point I wanted to make today. You know, you have to think into the future. And, you know, even if, you know, the laws passing in Alaska or Alabama or South Carolina or Texas, they're red states now. You got to protect that minority vote and the vote of the poor, because in the future, you know, with the way the Republican Party is moving and the demographics are changing, they will become swing states.
Well, I think there's a lot to recommend your thesis, Sergi. I would echo something that Benedict has said in the chat room, though, and he says the GOP would already be dead if the Democratic Party wasn't so avidly chasing them rightward. We can have Social Security cuts or Social Security cuts and legitimate rape. And that's the other thing. Remember, there's a fifth column of Republicans who are often referred to as conservative Democrats, or in the 2008 Congress were referred to as blue dogs, people who were Republican light. And remember, that's how we lost the majority in the House in 2010. It wasn't, with the exception of Alan Grayson, it wasn't a bunch of progressives getting defeated. It was the blue dogs being exchanged for real Republicans instead of phony baloney ones.
Yeah, people, you know, I guess, you know, it's kind of like the difference between diet soda and regular soda, I suppose, for the Republicans, for the right wing in this country.
I think you're right. Well, Sergi, it's very good to hear from you. And thank you for making that observation, because it's something that we should keep on our radar, and remember that, you know, every vote must count. Votes must count in Texas and Alabama as much as they do in Ohio and Michigan and Florida and Pennsylvania.
Yes, they do. And I'm glad to have called in, and I wish everybody a happy Labor Day.
Thank you kindly. You have a good evening now. Our new friend Sergi in the chat room, he is Biker Sergi. Jump on into the chat room. I can't type in there right now for some reason. Java is being persnickety again. So that I'm sitting here watching the chat room. I just can't participate in it. It's frustrating. But let's keep things rolling here. I've got a Skype call that's coming up next after this one. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello. Hello.
Hello?
Yeah.
Bob?
Yes.
It's Maura.
Maura?
Yes.
I am so glad to hear from you.
I've thought about you guys all the time.
Oh, you've been on our minds, and I told folks that you'd been under the weather, and this is just about the best phone call a fella could get on Labor Day.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I've been down from Georgia Post.
Oh, it sounds like, you know, our mutual friend has been keeping me posted. I was thinking about you just yesterday because I hadn't heard from her.
Right.
Are you home now?
No, I'm in the hospital.
Oh, goodness me. If you want to, tell folks, to the extent you can, tell them a little bit about what you've been through.
Well, I was first put in the hospital on August 2nd, right to ICU for 2 weeks. And then I went out onto the floor for two and a half weeks. Then they sent me off to rehab, and while I was there, I got so sick, they sent me back to ICU for 2 weeks. And it's just been in and out and in and out and in and out constantly.
Oh, my heavens. I did know some of this, and I had told folks that you weren't well. But if you're dialing and calling, you're feeling a little bit better then, I trust.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Today I feel much better.
Beautiful.
But I just wanted to say hello and tell everybody out there to know them, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Maura. It is such a joy and such a pleasure to hear your voice.
Well, thanks a lot. Love it all.
Love to you, too, and you get to feeling much, much better, okay?
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mom.
Bye, Maura. Bye-bye. I told you a while back that Maura wasn't feeling well. She has been, as she says, from pillar to post, and that's a beautiful, beautiful gift to have on this Labor Day Monday, is to hear that Maura is able to get up and get to the phone and communicate and talk to folks, and we'll keep rooting for her. Maura's been with us for a long, long time, and just happy to hear that she's better. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yes.
Hey. Hi, everybody.
Truth Seeker from the chat room, right?
Yeah, man.
Awesome.
I've been keeping it up for a while, but I finally called in, so.
Well, don't be afraid. Like I said, we've talked before, but, yeah, no, you'll be fine.
Yeah, my English is not, how do you call it?
Your English is what I call it, just fine. It beats the hell out of my Dutch.
Yeah, I heard your rant or the information that you gave about the mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me as it's disturbing, to be honest. It is very disturbing. It's very, very, very disturbing. And I thought that maybe you could do something by giving it more, making it newsworthy or something for the outside world.
We certainly need
the popularity.
We need all the help we can get, that's for sure.
So, I talked to Grant already, but I had to talk to you first before I could. I don't want to make certain decisions without informing you first. So.
Oh, sure, and we will work on this together, I hope, and make something that people can see easily and go far and wide. You know, there's a lot of data that you can take advantage of. It's all over there at ACACT.org. ACHEACT.org.
ACAT.
ACAT, yes. You know, you may not believe me, but for those few hours that I was passing through Amsterdam on the way home from Germany, I actually thought of you because, you're somebody, you know, I've seen you in the chat room so many times and everything, and, people remain very much in my mind, wherever I go, and, it felt a little more comfortable being in the Netherlands, knowing that there was somebody there who actually knew my name.
Yeah. If I knew that you were, when you were going to be in Amsterdam, maybe I could pass by or something.
Well, if I ever get through there with any, I was only there for 5 hours. I couldn't even get out of the airport.
Okay.
But if ever I am, I will give you a holler in advance. I'd love to have been able to get into the city.
I just want to, help to make it public or bring the news out more, and to places maybe here also can start something up. I'd like to talk to a friend of mine over here. But for that, I have to go to another state province.
Okay.
And then, we're going to start something up. Because I find it disturbing and unjust, so I'm not agreeing with it.
And thank you so much, because this needs to be known worldwide for the horror that it is, Truth Seeker. It does. And having you be part of this struggle means more than you know.
I am going to meet with the Dutch version of the, how do you call it, the protest movement.
Uh-huh.
On Friday. We're going to, bring it to light to them also.
Magnificent. Wonderful.
But, mostly they're here in occupying Rotterdam, but I'm going to talk to them maybe. Ways to make it more public,
Great, great. And if anybody has any questions, you can always give them my email address, and I'll answer any questions that anybody needs would care to ask.
I'm going to move something they say over here. So I don't know what the translation is, but...
That's something that would be a big help. There are a lot of scientific research papers, of course they're written in English, about what it means to have to live with mountaintop removal. If we had people who could begin translating those into other languages, it would be huge.
I can read and write English better than speak English. I don't know if it, maybe that's weird, but with me, things work the other way around, so to speak.
Well, I have no complaints with your spoken English either. But no, I've seen your writing in the chat room and everything. You would never know that. You weren't a native speaker by the way you write, so perhaps that's something we can talk about doing. I think that would be a great idea.
Yeah, I would like to translate it. When we had a website forum, and on that forum I translated the Dutch tech news into English or German a little bit, but mostly Dutch.
Okay.
And then I could do that with those news articles also. So.
I cannot tell you how important that could be. If we could gather together friends, you do Dutch, and I don't know, maybe we'll talk our buddy Scott in Sweden into doing the Swedish versions, and maybe Michael in Norway into doing the Norwegian version, and maybe a friend in Germany into doing the German version. We've got friends in France. We could cover the EU with these science papers so that no one would ever be able to say they didn't know it was happening. Because there's in almost every country of the EU, there is a bank that is financing mountaintop removal, and that's obscene.
I don't have the words. I get a man. That's disturbing. It's very disturbing.
And if I went and looked, I could probably find which Dutch bank is involved, but I'm sure that there is one. But we know, for instance, in Germany, Commerzbank is involved, Deutsche Bank is involved. In France, Société Agricole, another one that I can't remember. Credit Suisse, Royal Bank of Scotland, everybody seems to want a piece of Appalachia, and none of these banks seems to be willing to acknowledge what it is they're doing to get it.
Well, it's enough is enough, I guess. So, but it has to be known that the damage they are causing, because the most disturbing thing I find is that little children and just ordinary people are getting struck by this by illnesses that were never known before. So
it's the absolute truth. Well, I thank you very much for the offer, and we will work through it, and we'll make this happen.
I am going to mostly, I stay up, it's about 1:30 in the morning right now.
Yes.
Around 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock I go to bed, then I have to get up early.
Oh.
Maybe around 8, you know, but or earlier. But
well, I won't
I'll be
keep,
around I'll, until
okay,
3
I won't,
o'clock.
I won't keep you, but perhaps you continue talk. You talk with Grant and we'll talk together, okay?
Cool.
All right, good deal.
Good deal, man.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
From the Netherlands, that's our buddy Truth Seeker. He's in the chat room right now, and it was wonderful to hear his call. This is how we can win. This is how we can win a struggle for human rights in Appalachia. I think we're much more likely to win it with grassroots efforts like this than by bourbon and bluegrass bashes. Just saying. Onward to Dystopia, noting from the chat room, Truth Seeker speaks better English than some natives in this country. And that's the truth. That's the truth. You know, like I was talking on Friday, I love these little coincidences. I guess Dr. Jung would say that they're a function of synchronicity or something. The coincidence of me waiting. Let's see. Like I said, "I Am I Said" by Neil Diamond came out in 1971, and that line about "no one heard me, not even the chair," rattled around in my tiny mind for 41 years before I ever had a reason to, before suddenly, you know, there was Clint Eastwood talking to chair and it made perfect sense. Little coincidences. Over the weekend, in between watching college football games on Saturday, yes, my beloved Mountaineers didn't just win, they thrashed the bejesus out of Huntington High School, otherwise known as Marshall University, in the Friends of Coal Bowl. And mercifully, that will probably be the last Friends of Coal Bowl that we'll have to put up with. That made it was odious to watch it. Save for the straight-up butt-kicking that the Mountaineers delivered to the Marshall Thundering Herd. Little coincidences, though. In between watching football games on Saturday, I also got a link. Who sent it to me? It was News Ninja Gene. Gene gets up every morning and reads the entire internet and sends me the best part of it. And he sent me a link to the documentary series from the BBC from a couple of years ago called The Adventure of English. And the first segment of The Adventure of English, which is very well presented, I might add, it doesn't have so much of that stuff that with other more sensationalistic, you know, things like, "And this pile of dirt tells us that a great king waged war upon the..." And there's never a prosaic story about how people lived and died and raised farms and grew grain and had happy, and, you know, little children were born. No. Everything's got to be war and bloodshed and struggle for property and blah, 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 blah. Even though the data may not, but that's how we've learned to interpret it. But there was none of that really there. But the first episode of The Adventure of English had the presenters standing on the low ground of Friesland in the Netherlands, from whence came the original speakers of Oldie English, those tribal peoples, Angles and Saxons and Jutes and so forth. And I thought, my God, and I remembered being in the airport in Amsterdam, which was as far as I got, and thinking how much I wished that my flight was, that I could get out and see some of it. And I thought, my God, I want to see that too. And then lo and behold, little tiny coincidence, I had no idea this was going to happen, but our good friend Truth Seeker dials in from the Netherlands this evening. It's like another thing that struck me. Wow. And it's just weird. I told you, I've been reading this magnificent book by Barbara Tuchman, and I don't have a lot of reading time, so it's taken me quite a while, I admit. I mean, it's not like I read so slowly my lips move when I'm doing it, but it's taken a while to get through it. It's called A Distant Mirror. It's a history of the 14th century in Europe. And she pointed out and gave the date. It centers upon this one particular noble, a man named Enguerrand the Seventh. I'm probably mispronouncing that. The Sieur de Coucy, whose home base was the Chateau de Coucy in Picardy in France. And at the time, it was the most magnificent castle in all of Christendom, the Chateau de Coucy. The Donjon Tower was 19 stories tall. It was taller than, it was as tall as the towers of Notre Dame. And by way of epilogue and denouement to the whole story, when I got to the end of the book on Saturday, again, before the football started, she recounted the date in 1917 when, in an act of pure martial spite, the retreating Germans dynamited Chateau de Coucy and left it a ruinous shambles. The French government, in the years after the war, would preserve the ruin as what they called a monument to barbarity. Another German general, Prince Rupert of Bavaria, had implored General Ludendorff to leave the castle alone. But because Ludendorff was mad about having to retreat, and because Ludendorff didn't like General Rupert in the first place, he used some 28 tons of dynamite to blow up this single most magnificent expression of medieval architecture that remained in northern France. And lo and behold, that date, the date of that explosion in 1397, was 600 years to the day from the date of my youngest daughter's birth. And it kind of gave me a chill. And I recognize that there's nothing special in that. I mean, dates on calendars are dates on calendars. But I still have to think our youngest, they're all special, but there was something almost mystical about her arrival. She was born with a comet hanging in the sky. Hail Bop, it was, in 1997. And unlike Halley's, she can't do what Mark Twain said and say, I came in with Halley's comet and I'll go out with it. He was fond of saying that, Mr. Clemens was. Because, geez, Hale Bopp won't be around for a few more centuries. But I love those little coincidences. And we know enough to know what we don't know, I guess. I saw a letter. Do you remember several months back when our buddy, it was Sandra who sent it along, and then I think it was Dr. John who verified it. Yeah, I think it's the most viewed letter ever published at lettersofnote.com to my old master. I go there periodically, and I read things. and I loved this one. This particular entry, and I'd wanted to share it with you, and this sort of segues into it. In January 1936, a young girl named Phyllis wrote to Albert Einstein on behalf of her Sunday school class and asked, "Do scientists pray?" Her letter and Einstein's reply are below. Riverside Church, January 19, 1936, "My dear Dr. Einstein, we have brought up the question, do scientists pray in our Sunday school class? It began by asking whether we could believe in both science and religion. We are writing to scientists and other important men to try to have our own question answered." That's a mark that it was 1936 because only men are important. One wonders what kind of answer she might have received. Maybe the Sunday school class did write to Helen Keller or Eleanor Roosevelt or to Pearl S. Buck. "We will feel greatly honored if you will answer our question, do scientists pray and what do they pray for? We are in the sixth grade, Miss Ellis's class. Respectfully yours, Phyllis." On January 24, 1936, Dr. Einstein wrote immediately back to her, "Dear Phyllis, I will attempt to reply to your question as simply as I can. Here is my answer. Scientists believe that every occurrence, including the affairs of human beings, is due to the laws of nature. Therefore, a scientist cannot be inclined to believe that the course of events can be influenced by prayer, that is, by a supernaturally manifested wish. However, we must concede that our actual knowledge of these forces is imperfect, so that in the end the belief in the existence of a final ultimate spirit rests on a kind of faith. Such belief remains widespread even with the current achievements in science. But also everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that some spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, one that is vastly superior to that of man. In this way, the pursuit of science leads to a religious feeling of a special sort, which is surely quite different from the religiosity of someone more naive." It's a very gentle way of saying, "Phyllis, dear, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophies." I like to think that presented with the same question, I would be equally as gentle. But she says, "Do scientists pray?" In our Sunday school class, we asked this. And we began by asking whether we could believe in both science and religion. Dr. Einstein, being gentle and humane, jumped past that one. Or maybe he didn't. But the fact of the matter is, science does not and has not ever asked anyone to believe in it. Science has never called upon anyone for their faith. Only religion has the power to threaten you with some imaginary eternal torment done at the hands of a God who loves you so much he, she, or it is willing to torment you for all eternity. Only religion can do that. Science cannot. Education cannot. Only religion can promise you special torment if you do not follow the social engineering diktat of its so-called faith. But there was an echo, or not an echo, what do you call an echo that happens before the original sound? I don't know, maybe it's like relativism. Maybe it's relativity. But there was a reminder in what Dr. Einstein said to young Phyllis in Miss Ellis's sixth grade class. There was an echo of something that Carl Sagan would say decades later about that mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam, this pale blue dot, this little blue-green time machine hurtling through space. And what a sense of perspective that it gives. And perhaps lest I wax too philosophic, perhaps that perspective is in and of itself what we mistake for God. The insignificance that we are begs for some greater significance and leads to existential dark nights of the soul if we're not girded up to deal with them. Bob, you're piling it on pretty high and pretty damn deep. Well, yeah, I guess I am. I've thought a lot about what Labor Day means. I've thought a lot about how we actually honor the relatively inconsequential, tiny little things that each and every one of us must do to survive, that feel so monumental. And yet, in any kind of scope, are rendered so minute as to be microscopic. But as Arthur Miller said in Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid. Labor, the work of minds and hands and backs and legs and feet and sinews and days. Labor. It's Labor Day. How do you honor labor? And by that, I don't necessarily mean labor as in some monolithic, although it is hardly monolithic anymore, some monolithic concept. How do you honor someone from 100 years ago of whom you have but a photograph, an old woman seated outside a cane-backed rocking chair placed in a clearing in the weeds, grapevines and orchards and rough-hewn outbuildings blurring to inconsequence in the background. She wears a black, maybe it was blue, skirt that goes all the way to her ankles. Tiny boots are on her feet. Her blouse is buttoned up to her neck. Her sleeves are long. The only flesh of her being visible is from the chin up and her hands folded lightly on her lap. She had by that time had an entire host of sons and daughters, and she had worked from dawn to dusk every day of her life, until a few years ago her old home place was there. It was a ruin, and it was filled with old glass canning jars that, for all I knew, may have been handled by her. How do you honor her labor? How do you honor the labor of her husband, my multi-great-grandfather, Dick, of her father, Salathiel, a Welshman, who worked and prayed all his days. And each of you has some sort of story similar to this, a host of them, of grandmas and grandfathers, of great-grandparents of whom you were told only stories, as I was told only stories of Grandma Lizzie. How do you honor them on something that they never knew something called Labor Day. I do not have a certain answer, but I do have a suggestion that the honor lies in the memory. The honor lies in whatever tiny bit of voltage it takes to connect one brain cell to another brain cell and to hear your mother or your father or your grandmother or your grandfather or a cousin or a brother or a sister or an aunt or an uncle telling tales. What's left, the only thing that is left of those lives. That is how we honor the labor of the generations upon generations. That is how we do it. So we'll take a little break and come back. We've got about, 8 minutes to go before the hour. This Labor Day edition of The Horn, head on radionetwork.com. It takes your help to keep all of this going. And I thank you kindly for the contribution that came in this evening. The thank you note has already gone out. We need your help sincerely. It is how this continues. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So too is the snail mail address. 1038 The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, P as in Paul, M as in Mary, B as in Boy, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, West Virginia, 25801. And a reminder, if you're sending a check or sending a money order, please don't make it to Bob Kincaid. Make it to The Horn. Bob Kincaid does not get the money. The people who provide services to The Horn do. So you know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on, or direct dial 304-658-3333. This is Conversation Radio on Labor Day, 2012. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Sitting on a curb, I didn't know what about, but I was feeling quite disturbed. A street sweeper came whistling by. He was bouncing every step. It seemed strange how good he felt, so I asked him while he swept. He said, "It's my job to be cleaning up this place. That's enough reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the rest, and that makes the day for me. I got an uncle who owns a bank. He's a self-made millionaire. He never had anyone to love, never had no one to care. He always seemed kind of sad me, and I asked him why that was, and he told me it's because in my contract there's this clause that says it's my job to be worried after death, and that's the thing people respect in me. It's my job, but without it I'd be less than what I am. All my life writing songs and sleeping late, and any manual labor I've done was purely by mistake. If street sweepers can smile, then I've got no right to feel upset. But sometimes I still forget. Till the lights go on and the stage is set and the song is home, and you feel that sweat. It's my job to be different than the rest. That's enough reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the rest. And that's a rough phrase for me. It's my job to be cleaning up this mess. And that's enough reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the rest. And that makes today for me.
It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Bubble Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, stuff for my dog.
Holy crap! There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Bubble Genius. We got your soap right here.
And don't forget about that body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
No, it's not. I talked through that opener. Jeez. Nah, it's hour three. It's about 3 minutes before the hour, so we got to it a little bit early. Oh, stop that, Bob. Yeah, it's hour three. Because me, math, clocks, yeah, not so much. Talking about Coucy Le Chateau, our buddy Ray says, that is a real tragedy, a tragic loss. I really want a castle. I know. But can you just imagine the power bill? Those things were built for a non-electric age. Yeah. But this is the Labor Day edition of The Horn. And it's also Monday, but we're not really doing more in Monday because, well, God knows we've got an abundance of them, but nah. But, you know, we may have some more Anish nominees down the road. I got one in particular. I just love it when hillbilly and ignorance are conflated. And I've got a story here about the Honey Boo Boo Show. And the review of it is worse than the program itself. But before we do that, let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. Living in Colorado Springs, and as we talk, I'm dropping the phone and trying to get on the speaker.
Hey,
so
Kevin.
Give me a minute here.
Yeah,
okay, here we are.
Yeah, it's so much better when we're not on speakerphone.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to call and thank you for having the show tonight. I think by the number of callers you've had, it shows that your show, at least, has the following that people were turned on a holiday. And I often wonder sometimes, not every holiday, of course, Christmas, Thanksgiving, but some of the more minor holidays like today, especially with it being Labor Day, I wonder why more progressives didn't actually have a live show on. Because labor is so not talked about.
Well, to be fair, I don't know who did and who didn't do a show.
No, and I'm not criticizing anybody.
No, I mean, was there not a lot of live programming today?
As far as I could tell, any of the shows I listened to in the morning weren't live, and so I kind of expected them not to be. I didn't listen to any of the afternoon shows other than yours. Because it was a really good day for taking a nap. So before your show came on, I hopped in bed and took me a nice, long nap. That's what Labor Day is supposed to be.
A day to rest from labors.
Exactly. and it's a day also to honor labor.
See, I think this country would be far better off if we would adopt the notion of the siesta.
Oh yeah, I you've been to Spain, right?
No.
No, I went to Spain when I was in the Navy, and it was so awesome to see them do the siesta in the afternoon.
Well, and the thing is, that's not just a Spanish thing. I mean, the Italians do it, the Germans do it, the French do it, I guess. Yeah. Everybody knocks off for a couple of hours around lunch, and everybody understands that everybody's knocking off for a couple of hours around lunch, and it's just a lot more human.
Yeah, and it's also not meant to, we're going to grab every little dime out of your grubby little hands by keeping the convenience store open 24/7, and holidays, New Year's, Christmas, you know, out here, I can remember a day when the convenience stores weren't open on a Sunday. I'm sure you can. And I can remember a time when places like, oh, I don't know, Walgreens, to give an example, would not stay open for a holiday. And, of course, I am glad they stay open in case you need a prescription, but I'm talking about the grocery or the merchandise side.
Right. There are ways to build a society where people do not have to be ground into dust in order to maintain basic necessities.
Nope.
You know, I don't agree with closing things on Sundays just because, you know, it's the Lord's day off or whatever. But, you know, Saturday, Sunday, pick a day. I think it is a good idea to just have a day when everybody knocks off and gets to go and hang out with the family or whatever. And but in a brutal system such as ours, not working on Sunday means somebody isn't getting paid, because and not getting paid means some bill doesn't get taken care of. So
right.
You know, there's nothing reverent about our 7 day a week society, and I think that's kind of important to note, Kevin.
Very important to note, because I wasn't thinking of Sunday in terms of it being closed.
Oh, no, I know you weren't, but I mean, the origins of closing on Sunday come from religious dictate, the so-called blue laws that extended almost over this entire country at one point in time. You know, in the days before labor organizing, the only day you got off as a working person, back in the days of literally the 96-hour work week. Let's see, 96 divided by 7, 79, 110, 96, 27, 63. Yeah, 14-hour day, up thereabouts. You worked 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, but Sunday the company gave you off so that you could go to church and have the company's preacher tell you how you needed to be a good little prole and do what the company said, and be happy with the crappy wages you were paid and all of that. That's where, you know, that's the origin of the blue laws.
Yep.
It was just another expression of oppression.
Yes. They're still out there too. We just, in our county, I think it was 3-4 years ago, we actually voted to sell liquor on Sunday.
We still can't buy liquor on Sunday here in West Virginia. Now you can buy a bottle of wine, you can buy yourself some beer, but you best not be planning on buying no liquor on Sunday. It's just like the children of Israel having to gather manna before the Sabbath in double measure, because there wouldn't be none falling on the Sabbath. If you want liquor on Sunday, you have to buy a double measure on Saturday.
Yep. And I don't drink anymore, but it aggravates me every time I see this stuff. Because it is, it's a form of control, and the little fools are them wanting you to be a good little fool and follow the dictates of the preacher. It extends to even that, to where, oh no, you can't have a drink on Sunday. Well, what's the difference between having a drink on Sunday and a drink on Saturday? You know, there is no difference. It's another day.
Let me give you just a little bit of a take on the world I grew up in. First of all, the county I grew up in didn't even allow the sale of beer or wine until after I was gone to college. Okay, one. And they didn't sell liquor by the drink until after I was gone to college, and it was only a few scant, less than 10 years ago, that that county the county seat decided it would be okay to sell liquor by the drink in a restaurant, or beer by the glass, or wine by the glass in a restaurant on Sunday. That's how much a death grip the religion industry had on that area.
Yep. And isn't that scary to think that they have that bigger grip on it? Because it just frightens me. It's like Labor Day. I didn't hear anything from the president today about labor. I'm sure he put something out about it. But Romney's view of labor is, let's go kill another plant, send the jobs to China so we can share it with them. And, you know, I just wanted to call and honor labor. The people who, back in the early 1900s, started to form unions and sometimes gave their lives trying to do that, to make working conditions better. And yesterday, the Steelworkers Union down here they haven't ratified it completely, but they agreed on a labor deal, and now the blue-collar workers have to approve it. And, you know, without that, where would we be? And it's not the left that has caused all this trouble. It's people like Romney and the right who have sent these steel jobs overseas, manufacturing jobs overseas, just to make more of a profit. You know? And my father was a union man, and I just want to make sure that labor is mentioned, because it was the unions and blue-collar workers that made us what we once were, and it is now the destruction of those same unions that are making us into a third-world country. So,
by design. That phrase keeps popping up into the show periodically, but let's remember, by design, as you've noted, Kevin. Absolutely. Well, Kevin, I appreciate your call, and I thank you for your thoughts, and we will talk again soon, I hope.
All right, Bob, and hey, very good show. I love it.
Thank you. Take care, Kevin.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. By design. By design. And then this coming in from our buddy Isaac. I was married to a religious nut who thought it was a sin to have sex on Sundays. Ain't that a bitch? Yeah. Wow. But then again, there's the whole concept of Sunday. I don't know at what point in time was it where the religion industry decided that it was going to be Sunday instead of Saturday. Oh, that's right. Our Lord rose from the grave on Sunday. So, instead of the Sabbath being on Saturday, which is where it had traditionally been, it was moved to Sunday. I'm sure there was an economic reason for it somewhere along the way. You know what I mean? Because there kind of always is. But not even to be able to... Oh, that would be disturbing. Kate writing in from out on the front range. She says, labor union memories go back as far as my mother in the 30s. She was a lifelong member of the IBEW, telephone operator and a telephone pioneer. She often told horror stories about the bloody strikes in Indianapolis. In the 70s, her history gave me the courage to organize when I worked for Gulf Oil and P&M Coal in a refinery. I'm holding the memory of my ancestor, Grandma Kate, and her great-gram, who was born in Greene County, Tennessee, closely today. I'm grateful that my mother made her transition through the veil in 2000. She didn't understand anything that was happening to our society. I'm older than Granny T, and so glad that I'm old, says Kate. I'm saddened about just about everything. The best I can do is make someone smile at least once a day. You know what? If you can make somebody smile once a day somewhere, I think you get to walk around with a little badge on your shirt that just says mission accomplished. That was me editorializing. Kate closes saying, thanks for sharing your grandma, and thanks to all the new and different callers today. My money's in PayPal. Was waiting for you to share about your trips through Zip City for booze. Oh, God, we haven't even got there. Thank you. Thank you very much. We've made considerable progress this evening toward getting where we need to be in any given week. You know, if you take $2,500, as Kate said, hers was in the PayPal, and by Jove, there it is. Thank you, Kate. And thank you to another individual who consistently asks to remain nameless, which I will honor. The way it all breaks out is that we need to do about $625 a week in order to get to $2,500 a month. And this week shows promise, which means that this week we'll pay bills. So thank you very, very kindly. There is about, probably 45 minutes of conversation left in the program if you want to ring the line. I have to share something with you because this is from the geniuses at Funny or Die. And it is, this is dark humor. This is humor of the macabre. But we've all heard those pharmaceutical ads, you know, if you experience an erection that lasts for 4 hours, see a doctor, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, this is the pharmaceutical ad from the people at Funny or Die, funnyordie.com, for legitimate rape.
Are you a woman who sometimes finds it difficult to afford expensive birth control? If so, you're probably suffering from sexually liberated uterine tendencies, a serious medical condition. Fortunately, now there's a treatment that can help. It's called legitimate rape.
Legitimate rape activates the body's natural method for preventing pregnancy.
This rape is completely legitimate.
Let's shut this whole thing down.
It was always so hard to remember to take a pill at the same time every day. But with legitimate rape, I prefer not to think about it at all.
In clinical studies, legitimate rape did not prevent transmission of HIV or other STDs. Side effects of legitimate rape may include depression, nausea, insomnia, bruising, and accusations that you're just being hysterical.
Legitimate rape isn't for everyone. To find out if it's right for you, ask your doctor. Ask your congressman.
Under the legal definition of rape that Congressman Todd Akin, Paul Ryan, and 171 other Republicans co-sponsored last January, legitimate rape must be forcibly applied. In layman's terms, that means if you're just a 13-year-old who gets molested by your gym teacher, or a college girl who just gets drugged and wakes up naked in an unfamiliar room, under the Akin-Ryan rape guidelines, your rape is not legitimate. And that means you could still get pregnant.
Legitimate rape. It's like regular birth control, except as imagined by crazy people.
Ain't that the truth? It's worth noting, I think, it is worth noting that on this Labor Day, that labor is the mother of all movements for social change. It is because that there were risings of working people that other oppressed people found the courage to stand up, frequently with the support of labor that was back then much more militant, much more radical, and much more determined. The women's suffrage movement got a big boost from the rise of labor. Early labor organizations were among the first to integrate the races. Among the very first labor organizations to be colorblind was the United Mine Workers of America, and that's a fact. Because you know what? When you die, and when you're dying in dark, gassy holes, nobody's concerned with anybody's skin color. because everybody is covered in Cole's filth. Labor is the mother of most of the movements toward freedom that the 20th century saw rise in this country. It is for that reason that the right wing, the Republican Party et al., work so tirelessly to destroy labor in this country. Because in so doing, they know that when the first domino falls, others fall in series after it. And that's the reality. Other things? No, I told you there was two things I've talked about this evening. Labor issues and this issue of hillbilly self-determination. Well, we'll add a third, sort of, but it has a tangential quality to it as well. I've told you about this odious porsploitation, thank you, Sandra, for the word, program on TLC about Honey Boo Boo Chow. Well, there's a writer over at a website called TheBlemish.com. Don't go there. Don't give them the traffic. But Agnes alerted me to this article, and I went and read it, and I shuddered with a sort of horror. The headline, Honey Boo Boo's niece has four fingers and two thumbs. Ho, 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 let's make some inbreeding jokes now. Ho, I don't care. Them incest jokes, they're funny. I don't care who you are. Victor, whose last name is, I think, Snark, writes, it must be a given that if you're born into the Honey Boo Boo family, you're going to be dealing with a few abnormalities. Their genes are about 80% recessive. Now see, that's not true. That's just some bullshit put out there. I mean, I'm not going to defend this program, and I'm not, the circumstances of 16-year-old teen pregnancies and so forth. You know what? It ain't because anybody has recessive genes that we wind up with that. That, too, is a socially engineered problem. It's also a human evolution problem. And by that, I mean, it's a problem created by the fact that our bodies are capable of reproducing at ages when in our arguably technologically advanced society, we don't need them to. But naturally, the corporate global transnational world doesn't give a damn about that and is in fact pumping so many chemicals into our into our world that our daughters are becoming fertile and experiencing precocious puberty at earlier and earlier ages. So it has nothing to do, Victor, with 80% recessive genes. But Victor continues in that all too snotty way by saying, knowing that, it's not shocking that the newest member of the family, Caitlin, who was born to 18-year-old teen mom Anna, came out with four fingers and two thumbs on her right hand. Picture. Ho, ho, ho. Mama June loves her nonetheless. Really? Really? She didn't take her out and expose her on a mountaintop for being born with two thumbs on one hand? Loves her nonetheless. God damn. Mama June said, we have embraced the abnormality. We have embraced it. It makes Caitlin more special to us. Then, whoever this shitheel is, writes, the only bad thing about being born with two thumbs is it's going to be a lot harder for Caitlin to decide which one to suck on. On the other hand, she'll be one of the few people able to give something three thumbs up. Ha 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 ha! Oh, isn't it? Oh, how droll! My goodness, go and get me a glass of Merlot, would you? The superiority is simply leaking off the page. Oh, lovey, I do so like it when you're funny like that. But then this one, and this is the one that's got me kind of head up. In related news, expect this kid to be as hillbilly as the rest of the family. They're already dipping the kid's pacifier in Code Red Mountain Dew before putting it in her mouth. I guess they figure since she's going to be losing all her teeth anyway, might as well get a head start. Ain't no granddaughter of mine going to fall behind, said Mama June. Again, I'm no fan of this program. I find it disturbing. I find it pitiable that this 18-year-old young woman has given birth to a child and will be a parent instead of continuing to be a student. But she stayed. But you know what? She stayed in school. And she at least has the support network of a mama, grandma, who will help take care of the baby so she can graduate high school. Maybe grandma will even help take care of the baby so she can go to college. Maybe. But no, some snarky piece of shit named Victor somewhere thinks this is all funny, and then expect this kid to be as hillbilly as the rest of the family. Hillbilly. Hillbilly. You'll pardon me if I'm not laughing. One, this family's in Georgia, and unless they're in the North Georgia mountains, they're not hillbillies. Like I said, I'm an Appalachian, and I've got a voice. And I take real umbrage at the use of hillbilly by people who don't even geographically know what one is. Just because you've seen Uncle Jed on the TV Land reruns does not entitle you to comment about hillbilly culture. I'm guessing this dumbass has never so much as opened the front cover on Joe Bajant's magnificent Deer Hunting with Jesus. Yeah, it takes a real man to make jokes about a baby born with two thumbs on one hand. I tell you what. Disgusting. But let's go on laughing. Let's go on laughing at the ignorant trolls, you know, because they're the ones that caused all these problems to begin with, right? I mean, it's not the Bishop Willard Romneys of the world, is it? It's not the Eric Cantors. It's not the Paul Ryans. It's not the multinational trans-global corporations who have a desperate need for people to be desperate and ignorant so that they will work for next to nothing. No, they're not the problem. Government's the problem! Save me. There you go. As hillbilly as the rest of them. Because, you know, we're all born with extra thumbs. Doesn't have anything to do with corporate toxins being pumped into the air and the water. No, no. It's because their genes are 80% recessive. See how this shit gets around? First, it's the National Mining Association saying it a couple of years ago, and now we got some snarky ass blogger blaming inbreeding and so-called recessive genetics for the kind of birth defects that we see in communities that are plagued by corporate rapine and plunder. Gonna be a lot harder for Caitlin to decide which one to suck on.
Ho, 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 ho! Dang, he's funny.
Not. Jesus. But, you know, that supercilious sense of unmerited superiority is all around for anybody who cares to go and look and find it. I got some more right here. Then again, Jim, noting, well, Anne Boleyn of the Howards, second wife of Henry VIII, had six fingers. Ever heard of this? Have you? No, Jim, I haven't. Thank you. Maybe Victor over at The Blemish can write something snarky about that. Jeebus. But no, it is not limited to snarky cable channel TV watchers. Some folks can't learn. Tom Smith, Senate candidate from Pennsylvania, is having a little bit of a learning problem. You'll recall that Tom Smith of Pennsylvania is the horse's rear end who said that having a daughter who had a pregnancy out of wedlock. I kind of hate that word, wedlock. Come here, honey, let's get them ankle, let's get them manacles on you. We're going to lock you down to your new husband after he's paid me the 15 sheep, 2 camels, 3 goats, and an oxen, brace of oxen that he's paid me for. Yeah, wedlock. Yeah, Tom Smith said his daughter having a baby without being married was, you know, the same kind of dilemma that a woman who's pregnant from a rape faces. Well, he's out there on the hustings. And week before last, he was caught on tape. I love video cameras and video phones. And he come up on a couple of little women folk a-talking. You know, empty heads and vacuous. And you know, can't talk about that important stuff the men folk are talking about, right?
All right, what are we talking about here? Two girls together talking.
We're talking about cars.
My guess would have been you were talking about shoes. I know that's what.
I know, it's a little noisy. Shall I translate? He's working the handshake line. Yeah, you heard that nasally voice. Yeah, that's a voice made for print. Yeah, what are we talking about here? Two girls together talking. The woman that he had spoken to said, "We're talking about the power of petite women." He responds, this guy who wants to sit in the Senate of the United States and represent every woman in the state of Pennsylvania, responds, "My guess would have been you were talking about shoes." You know, because the women folk, they talk about those things. They can't think the big thoughts that make their women folk brains hurt so much. "I thought you were talking about shoes." "Really? You were talking about power and petite women, and I thought you were talking about shoes." Well, damn it, that's what they should have been talking about, Tom Smith. You don't want, I mean, you know, I'm sure Tom's a member of the, he's a pig lick, and I'm sure he's a member of the religion industry, and therefore he understands that it is a shame for a woman to speak in public. And that if she has any questions, she should ask her husband when she gets home. You know, that's what that inerrant book says, that book that is the perfect expression of the will of God Almighty. That's what that says. It's a shame for a woman to speak in church. And by implication, women are competent only to talk about shoes. Or maybe what they'll fix for their husbands for dinner.
Yeah. Damn.
Yeah. So, check out the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm well, Jim. How are you?
Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day to you.
Well, you know, I'm not a hillbilly. I'm a transplant, if you've referred to me as a four, and that's fine with me. I'm a native South Carolinian. However, I have discovered since living here that the arts and crafts of this state are remarkable.
Yes, they are. And those are heritage things that have been passed down generation unto generation.
I mean, before I ever even thought about moving here, I collected Fiesta. Where does Fiesta ware come from?
Well, that would be West Virginia.
I also collect Blanco glass, which is, I think, made in this state as well.
It is indeed.
And, you know, there are a number of arts and crafts that contribute significantly to the wealth of this nation, aesthetically, economically.
Jim, I have a quilt hanging in this studio.
Oh, yeah.
That my mother made. And the stitches, the quilting stitches on it, are so tiny and so tight that you could not measure it with any of the demarcations on a ruler. That is the degree of detail and artistic ability that went into that.
Well, look at Tamarack.
Yeah.
And the architectural design of that. I mean, you'll see some beautiful things in there that are indigenous to this state.
Indeed, indeed.
And
woodworking, pottery,
Whether it's woodworking, pottery, or music that comes from a combination of wood and steel.
There's no end to this talent, but I do want to take you back for just a second here. You said, you know, you noted that, come from South Carolina. Bear in mind that, for instance, this, supercilious horse's rear end who wrote that piece, he considers anybody, who is a southerner to be a hillbilly.
Well, he's mighty damned ignorant. I mean, if we want to go south, we can go to Charleston, South Carolina. That was the very first place in America.
Anybody who doesn't speak with a flat Midwestern standard broadcast accent is a hillbilly to this clown.
I mean, listen, in Charleston, South Carolina, the first theater, Dock Street Theater, in the New World, or in North America. The first place where Mozart was played, Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh yeah.
So,
but that's all inconvenient, Jim. It doesn't fit as well into this into this overarching theme that if you have a southern accent, you must by definition, therefore, not have an IQ above the Fahrenheit measurement for freezing.
Well, I understand that, but then, you know, I'm just as proud of being a South Carolinian as you are of your own heritage. And there are a number of things that, you know, from my state, besides some of the stuff you hear today, that go back 300 years when New York City was a village on the Hudson.
Yes, absolutely.
A lot of bad things too, but nonetheless, we've got to give the devil his due, or we've got to get, together to give the respective states their own contributions. And, you know, these aspersions that people cast and things like that, not only are they unkind, they're without merit.
Unkind, ill-mannered, ain't got no raisin, as some might say. But you know, there's a deeper thing that I think is begging for a larger and deeper analysis, Jim, and that is this. You know, I've seen it with this book that has come out that seems to have a life of its own now. It's called Better Off Without 'Em, and it's an argument for, I guess, compulsory secession, that we would, that the United States would somehow throw the South out of the Union. And you know, that things are, you know, and you know, you've heard it and I've heard it, and you know, and we've even talked about it on this program, you know, why do people vote against their own best interests? Well, the one thing that occurs to me, and I'm going to try to be more careful going forward, because I do try to learn, Jim, and I know you do as well. We say things like, you know, those Southerners vote against their own economic best interests. And there was a very famous book called What's the Matter with Kansas that talked about that. But maybe, as Joe Bagent pointed out, maybe these folks aren't voting against their own best interests. Maybe they have entirely different value systems. Maybe they have entirely different interests. Maybe it does matter more to them that religion be taught in schools than that biology does. I think that's wrong. I think you would probably say that's wrong. But there, what I'm getting at is there is an implied elitism and a certain snobbery that goes along with saying that their values are de facto wrong.
Oh, I don't understand that at all, because in South Carolina, I was never taught religion in schools. I was taught religion in church school in my local parish.
But there's a determined effort all over the South now to teach religion in schools, to, for instance, erase any mention the way they approach it now, Jim, is to teach the controversy.
I don't know about that. I think you've got a very, you know, it's just amazing how certain minorities can gain the ascendancy while others just remain silent and just sort of kind of look down on them.
And in this particular instance, I think you're talking about
about the fucking Tea Party.
Yeah, a particularly noisy, entrenched, regressive, right-wing movement that's basically know-nothings. But because they are so noisy, they get the attention of people. Right?
Well, that's basically it. I mean, they make the most noise, and of course, because these people are, what's the word I'm trying to find? Susceptible to any type of dogma that will suit whatever they believe in for their own reason, that they are selected by, a lot of these Republicans who have come forth and are presenting the South in a very bad light. Now, I will admit, in the South, and, you know, I've seen it, and I've grown up with it, all these stickers that I've seen, these Confederate flags, forget hell, and
eat more possum, delicious with sweet taters.
Well, I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, I grew up with that one, too.
No, I didn't. You know, like I say, you know, you and I just grew up in a different situation, I guess, religiously and in some other words, but, I mean, I've seen it. And I can remember going through the dry cleaners on a Saturday afternoon and seeing Klan robes.
Well, one of the things
hanging
with this,
up in
one of the things,
the one-hour martinizing place, and I had to ask the proprietor. I said, "Do you do bed sheets?" And the lady said, "No, honey, those are Klan robes." And I said, "Oh my god! Oh my god!" And I remember one night, some friends and I actually had heard of a Klan meeting. Oh, you'd have to hear of it because you saw the handbills posted. And it said, here's the clear truth spoken by really white men. And there was this kind of cul-de-sac or someplace out on the outskirts of Camden, my hometown. And so we crawled up there and went to it to, just to see it and the cross burning. And we also noticed the highway patrol was out there taking down license plate numbers. So I came back and I told my dad about it, and he said, oh my God, of all the places you would have to go on a Saturday night, freaking Klan meeting. He said, don't you know that you're going to be on the Attorney General's list? And the, any, your license plate was taken down? He said, whose car did you drive?
Your father had a way of coming back to the practical, didn't he?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I can remember, I had an uncle who was the postmaster, and he had a band, and he would play at different places and stuff like that. It was just avocation. He was very musically talented. He was a great pianist. And he and this other guy had gone, I think, to Charlotte, and they were coming back one night. And this guy had made a statement about his friend, about he wouldn't mind having a black woman's shoes under his bed or whatever. Well, they got stopped by the Klan. My uncle was allowed to proceed. This man ended up in the hospital, and his picture was on the front page of the Camden Chronicle. I mean, this guy looked like he had been the victim of stormtroopers. You wouldn't believe how bad this guy looked. I mean, his face was more black than blue, and the picture was in black and white. So there are a lot of things. I mean, you know, the South in one way has produced a great deal. I mean, we're talking about, for example,
well, you know, the first things through my mind, Faulkner, I mean, Eudora Welty, Flannery O'Connor.
Well, of course. I mean, you're talking about
Robert Penn Warren, Alan Tate.
And what about musicians who mentioned in The Garden of Good and Evil? What was his name? Excuse me.
Well, musicians that, you know.
Mercer.
Yeah, Louis Armstrong, Nina Simone.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
William Christopher Handy. And your fellow South Carolinian, David, from South Carolina, wrote in a few minutes ago and said, where the F would the would USA literature and music be without the South? Just saying.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Tennessee Williams.
There. Thank you.
And, of course, these people normally...
Thomas Wolfe.
Right. I mean, Billie Holiday was from, the Midwest? She was from where?
How about Hank Aaron? How about Willie Mays? Every part of the country has contributed to the greatness of this country, but there seems to be a problem with some folks think constantly wanting to diminish the contributions that, you know, if I mention William Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor, or Eudora Welty, or Robert Penn Warren, that doesn't mean that I'm in any wise discounting Jack Kerouac, Ernest Hemingway, you get the idea.
Oh, yeah.
But there
Absolutely.
Are some people who simply want to overlook any value whatsoever. And as I've said before, progressive people in the South are among the most dedicated and ferocious uncompromisingly progressive that I've ever met.
Well, in many cases, it's because a lot of them have escaped that particular mindset and have gone to other parts of the country, you know?
Yeah, but by the same token, they are forever shaped by the place from which they came.
Well, that's the part of it. I mean, could Tennessee Williams have written what he wrote had he not had the background he had, or could Truman Capote have written what he wrote had he not had...
Helen Keller could neither see nor hear, and yet she is as much an imprint of the South as people who were more fully abled. I mean,
absolutely. By the way, did you ever get to the National Cathedral to see where Helen Keller and her companion...
That is still on the list. We have not yet, and I want to make sure that I want to make sure that Ferg's with me when we do that, because that's something he wants to see especially.
Well, basically, it's a stone, and I think behind the stone is a columbarium that contains the ashes of Helen Keller and Anne Sullivan.
She called her simply teacher.
Right, her teacher, exactly. So very well played by Anne Bancroft.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just very bad that, that people are gonna, try to, I guess what they're trying to do is to compensate for their own inadequacies by making some type of slur or negative remark about somebody else. I think it's some type of compensatory behavior that will cover up some serious character flaw in their own psyche.
Yeah, I got an interesting comment coming in here from Ron in Raleigh, another true son of the South, under the subject line, the Klan, and this is going to come off kind of strange, but I know what he means. He says, you know, Bob, I kind of miss the Klan of my youth. This new breed of paramilitary camo-wearing horses' asses and their allegiance with identity Christians give me pause. God, it's bad when you can even get... And I should add, in case anyone who doesn't know, Ron has made clear in previous posts that he's a man of color. So, you know, there's kind of a double dose of irony that comes with a line like that.
I guess so. I don't know, but, I mean, this business of making these remarks about the South succeeding and stuff like that is, it would appear incredulous to me. I mean, in spite of our divisions back before and during the Civil War and after, it's no great page in our history. But nonetheless, it's still with us, and it will continue to be with us, and I hope it will continue to be with us. And I just hope that a very vocal minority does not attempt to paint us with the same brush.
Well, the sad thing is that things like this book...
It doesn't take a whole lot to really... It doesn't take but one apple to spoil the barrel, Bob.
That's true. That's true. And the thing that's disturbing is that this book is coming from someone who is arguably and ostensibly liberal and progressive. And as such is troubling, to say the least.
Well, I think that's the dog in the manger there. I don't know how progressive and liberal he can be to make comments about, what, a girl with two thumbs?
Oh, no, no, no. That's a different jackass. Now, I'm talking about the guy who wrote this book, Better Off Without Him, and, talking, urging Southern secession.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I mean,
and by the way, David in South Carolina, adding to our list, Southern writing, Hunter S. Thompson, William Gibson, Stephen Colbert, Shelby Foote, Edgar Allan Poe. What a variety, David
says.
Yeah,
absolutely incredible. I mean, these guys, have contributed to the mainstream of American literature.
And the quantum of knowledge, Jim.
Of course. I mean, that goes without saying. When I say volume, that includes everything from top to bottom as far as style, content, contribution, and elevation of the human mind in every way, shape, and form. And they were, in many cases, they were very troubled spirits. I mean, Edgar Allan Poe was a very troubled spirit. So was Tennessee Williams. But in spite of their problems and things of that nature, they contributed significantly. No wonder many of them went to Provincetown, Massachusetts, so they could feel free to...
Yeah.
Express themselves and to write. And, you know, a lot of Southerners ended up in P-Town.
Very true. And a lot of them have been around the world and gone back home. I think, you know.
Yeah, they have. And we can't. And
we are the better for them being there, Jim.
Yep, I think we are. So, I mean, you know, but as far as Southern secession is concerned, no, I don't think so.
Well, it's bad enough when the goofy ass governor of Texas starts talking that crap. But it becomes doubly so when, again, somebody who claims to be liberal and progressive starts making the argument for him.
Well, the only thing I can say to that idiot is this, and it's what Andrew Jackson said. The Union must and will be preserved.
Yeah, and maybe we need to...
And to those people, his own vice president, John C. Calhoun, he said, yeah, you keep that up, and I'll come down there, and I'll hang you higher than the Haman.
That's the truth I was about to say, and it is well to remember what Tennessee and Andrew Jackson said about some of your forebear antecedents in South Carolina. If I don't hear an end to this secession talk, I'm going to get a rope, and I'm going to come down there, and I'm going to hang the first secessionist I find, and I'll come to the next one, and I'll hang him, and I'll hang them all if I have to.
Well, Bob, I'm afraid a lot of my family would have been hanged.
Well, no, that was 1832.
When the nullifiers.
The nullification, yeah.
Yeah, Stephen Decatur Miller and all that stuff. And Stephen Decatur Miller said slavery is not a necessary evil, it's a positive good. But
yeah, that was Joel John C. Calhoun made that statement.
No, it was Stephen Decatur Miller who said that.
Oh, then Calhoun may have lifted it because he's also credited with it because he turned it into a speech on the floor of the Senate.
Well, Stephen Decatur Miller once said it, and he was governor of South Carolina from, I think, 1828 to 1830, but he's also in the family tree. And
is he really?
Uh-huh. Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, same church, Church of the Holy Cross at Statesburg. Sure is. He went west after the movement of the South to go west to find more land for cotton and stuff like that. But if you ever get to South Carolina, and if you can drive down to near Sumter, South Carolina, I invite you to go to Church of the Holy Cross. It's just a beautiful Episcopal church made of pied a terre.
Oh my.
And all around there are trees that are just laden with Spanish moss.
Oh, it is undeniably beautiful.
And across the road is my family's ancestral home.
Across from the church, I'll be darned.
Mm-hmm. Across the highway. As a matter of fact, Nathaniel Green made it his headquarters.
That's a heritage, Jim.
It is, and I'm proud of it, in spite of the mistakes that were made by a lot of people who or proponents of it. But nonetheless, I digress too much, and I'm going to let you go.
Well, Jim, have yourself a wonderful evening, and again, a happy Labor Day to you.
And to you and your family.
All right. Bye now.
Take care.
And thus we find ourselves approaching ourselves, yeah, because I are been to school to learn how to talk English real good-like. And thus we find ourselves at the end of the program. Thank you very much. Oh, Jim, you'll appreciate this. David in South Carolina noting, I've been to that church. Well, if you know the house across from the church, that David, that's Jim's family's ancestral residence. Thanks everybody for joining in, and I'm so glad you were here. It's been a real pleasure. I wish I could have typed in the chat room, but the computer's just not cooperating. Again, I wasn't being aloof or anything. We've had wonderful conversations this evening. First-time callers, Skype caller, from the Netherlands. Thanks again, Truth Seeker. Thank you all. You make this all so special. Thank you, Maura, for calling in tonight and letting us know you're getting better. That means a great deal, because we are, after all, a little family here, albeit a family that is a growing one. Thank you for your concerted efforts on behalf of the AIC Act, H.R. 5959. You know, Congress will be coming back into session next week about this time. They get a lot of vacations, Congress does. But they'll be coming back into session for about a week and a half next week. And now would be a great time to start calling and emailing, encouraging your elected representatives to sign on to the AIC Act. H.R. 5959. We're going to be making a big push all the way to the end of this Congress so that it'll be that much easier to get to have co-sponsors in the next one. And you are a huge part of that push. When you advocate for the AIC Act, you are speaking up for a voiceless region. And I said something earlier about not appreciating people talking for me who don't really want to end mountaintop removal. When you speak up and ask for co-sponsorship and passage of the AIC Act, you're asking for the end of mountaintop removal. And those are the voices that we need. Anything you need to know about the AIC Act can be found at aicact.org, A-C-H-E-A-C-T.org. Go there, find out what you need, call your elected representatives. We got any Atlanta listeners? We really need John Lewis on this bill, and he's not there yet. And a civil and human rights hero like John Lewis should be on this bill. Could you make that call? We still need Frank Pallone on this bill. We still need Ed Markey on this bill. It would be great to have Barney Frank on this bill. We still need, Representative Dix from Washington State on this bill. We need Jim McDermott on this bill. We need Bob Filner on this bill. We need Henry Waxman on this bill.